Welcome to the KRS Molecular Minute Podcast. It's your host, Shadi Nabhan. I'm the chairman of the Precision Oncology Alliance at KRS Life Sciences. The Precision Oncology Alliance is a collaboration of many institutions from across the globe, mainly in the U.S., collaborating on big data, biomarkers, molecular studies to advance the care of all patients diagnosed with cancer. It is September 2023, and I couldn't be happier than hosting Drs. Charu Agarwal and Balaj Halmos. Dr. Agarwal is from University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Halmos is from Montefiore Albert Einstein in New York. They both came on the show on the KRS Molecular Minute podcast to chat about adjuvant and neoadjuvant therapy for resected non-small cell lung cancer. Should we give treatment before resection? Should we give treatment after resection? How do we make these decisions? What are the current states of therapies? How do we choose which type of treatment? Is it chemotherapy, immunotherapy, targeted therapy? So much has changed in the way we manage patients with non-small cell lung cancer. And these two phenomenal, world-renowned thoracic oncologists are going to clarify everything to you so that after listening to this podcast, after finishing this podcast, you are going to know everything pertaining to neoadjuvant and adjuvant treatment for lung cancer. Before I air this episode, I'm going to ask you to subscribe to the KRS Molecular Minute podcast and refer your friends and colleagues to it. Don't forget to rate the podcast. Write a quick review. This allows folks to find this podcast depending on the topic that they are looking for. I'm very grateful to my guests. Couldn't be more grateful to them to spending some time of their busy schedule to educate us all on adjuvant and neoadjuvant therapy for lung cancer, Drs. Agarwal and Halmos on the KRS Molecular Minute podcast. Charu, we'll start with you. I don't think there's anyone who's listening to the show who doesn't know who you are, but just in case.
Thanks, Shadi. You're very kind. I'm Charu Agarwal. I'm an associate professor for lung cancer excellence at the University of Pennsylvania's Abramson Cancer Center. I'm also the associate director for Penn Center for Cancer Care Innovation, as well as the physician leader for our Airways Clinical Trials Program.
Wonderful to have you. And Balaj?
I'm Balaj Halmos, a medical oncologist at Montefiore Einstein Cancer Center, where I oversee the thoracic program, and I also serve as associate director for clinical research.
It's great to have you. And the topic is pretty focused. So we want to talk about this adjuvant, neoadjuvant therapy, because there was a time where there was no role for any of that stuff, right? The classic answer to abort question was that you just do surgery and that's really it. There's nothing really you could do after that. Things have evolved, and obviously, you know, we started giving chemotherapy after surgery, and then it continued to evolve. I mean, all of these things. So I want to start by talking about the standard of care today, and then we'll talk about other things. So today, Charu, if somebody undergoes surgery for early stage lung cancer, what do we do afterwards?
Yeah, so I think this is a great point to just establish how we define early stage lung cancer. And I would just say that in my view, there is early stage lung cancer, there's early stage lung cancer, and then there is locally advanced lung cancer. And previously, I think before the approvals of neoadjuvant or adjuvant treatments, I think these were sort of lumped together as early stage / locally advanced, but now we are realizing that there are key distinct differences. So what do I mean by these? I think early stage lung cancer is those really stage 1A non-small cell lung cancers by the current AJCC definition that were really not included in any of the clinical trials and should really just only get surgery. Where the data is emerging is for these other lung cancer, sort of your stage 2s, your stage 3As in the AJCC 8th edition, where we can really think about using perioperative approaches, either new adjuvant, adjuvant combination, any combination, basically. And then I just want to stress that we should really have a subset of patients that don't need surgery, right, or shouldn't undergo surgery. As actual stage 3Bs or patients with locally advanced non-small cell lung cancer, we have very good options for them. Chemoradiation followed by immunotherapy is a very relevant option associated with survival benefit. And, you know, I think there has been a recent push to potentially consider surgery for these early stage patients, right? They're locally advanced, but on sort of on the late end of the right end of the spectrum. And I just want to say that I don't know if there's a current standard of care for this middle group, which is stage 2 to 3A. There's a lot of different options, but there's no one gold standard approach. And I wonder, Balaj, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, great introduction, Charu. You know, I think number one, nowadays, patients shouldn't just go to surgery to begin with. I think this is where I think our multidisciplinary teams are so important to make sure that the staging has been done correctly. Nowadays, we have better technologies to make sure that the staging is done right, making sure that the biomarker testing needed, you know, has been completed, making sure that we've considered whether adjuvant therapy or neoadjuvant therapy is better. So I think the multi-D team has an even earlier role in terms of making sure that the patient path is correct. Now, if ultimately the patient gets surgery and post-surgery, we see the patients for adjuvant treatment decisions. Of course, we've seen a lot of changes recently, and those changes now have added to the previous conversation about adjuvant chemotherapy. Platinum-based doublet chemotherapy has been the standard of care, especially for node-positive patients post-surgery. Minimal benefit, that's the reality. And the longer you follow these patients, you know, the less impressed we are about those benefits. So it's nice to see now much bigger changes with the introduction of adjuvant targeted therapy for the appropriate, you know, patient subsets with EGFR-mutated lung cancers based on the ADAURA study, as well as at least some, you know, hope, you know, for significant benefits from immunotherapy as well, where we've seen two studies with positive outcomes when it comes to DFS benefits. Still not certain about how that will translate into an OS benefit and how the biomarkers will influence our decisions as to adjuvant immunotherapy, but definitely has to be part of the conversation now. So biomarker testing, EGFR, PD-L1 at a minimum is very critical to make sure those decisions are made correctly.
But I guess there are, so let's go through a scenario. There are two types of patients. There's a patient that comes to you, Charu, who's already had surgery. You had no say in that. The surgeon operate on that patient and they're sent to you for discussion of additional therapy. And there's the patient that we'll talk to Balaj about who still hasn't decided what to do. And you need to do this multidisciplinary approach and you got to really see what do I do. So a patient comes to your clinic, already had surgery. You can't really go back. How do you decide additional therapy for a patient who has undergone surgery?
Yeah, great point. And I think we would still follow the principles of evaluating the stage, making sure that they had a complete resection, a complete oncologic surgery, that they've had not just a wedge, especially for larger tumors, that they've undergone a completion lobectomy and have had adequate nodal dissection. If all of that has been performed, you know, it's very important to just mention that molecular testing is so important across all stages of lung cancer now, even more so than before, because we can institute adjuvant targeted therapy. I mean, for the first time, we're seeing a survival benefit in the adjuvant space. That's by proper selection of patients. So, you know, I would, if I see such a patient, I would evaluate the stage. I would evaluate the resection type. Are there clear margins? Are there unclear margins? Are there involved margins? And then look at PD-L1 and molecular status and really come up with a plan, really thinking about administering adjuvant chemotherapy for those with nodal involvement and coming back in with either immunotherapy or targeted therapy, especially if they haven't received immunotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting. And if they have a PD-L1 positive tumor, don't have a molecular alteration, I think it behooves us to have that discussion with the patient and offer it, given two approvals in this space.
So you do give immunotherapy after chemotherapy in almost all patients now, or?
I don't necessarily do it in all patients. I think this is somewhere where potentially Balaj and I could debate and argue. I think the data is really good for patients with high PD-L1 status. We are seeing DFS benefits with hazard ratios at the 0.49 range or 0.43 with the use of adjuvant immunotherapy. The benefit sort of seems to diminish as the PD-L1 level drops. So PD-L1 1 to 49%, yes, benefits, but not as the same extent as PD-L1 greater than 50. And then at least with one of the two drugs that's approved, we haven't really seen a benefit with PD-L1 negative tumors. So with atezolizumab on the IMpower010 trial, in the PD-L1 negative tumors, there wasn't a significant DFS benefit. And actually, the drug is not approved for PD-L1 negative tumors. The FDA label states PD-L1 greater than 1% stage 2 and higher resected tumors after receiving chemotherapy. So I tend to sort of follow that guidance a little bit, recognizing that long-term immunotherapy can cause complications. And if I'm not really getting a benefit, what is the point? And, you know, we quite haven't seen mature overall survival data either with these drugs.
It's very hard to disagree on Charu on many different things, including, you know, what you just stated. I might just say that we're in a state of confusion a little bit. And I think that explains why, you know, we're enthusiastic about immunotherapy, but we're not giving it to everyone. We have two randomized studies, and both of them show a DFS benefit. None of them have read out really to the point that we could understand the OS impact. And when you look at the subset data, they are just, you know, one is kind of turning, you know, the other upside down. In the IMpower study, the PD-L1 high positive patients benefit a lot more. In fact, that's the only subset where there's an overall survival benefit trending. In the other two subsets, less than 1%, 1 to 49, the survival curves completely overlap when it comes to OS. But when you look at the PRO study now, looking at pembrolizumab in a very similar context, the subsets are the complete opposite. So this created a lot of confusion. As a result, the neoadjuvant literature here is just a lot more robust and consistent. So if I want my patient to benefit from immunotherapy, I sort of think that I can deliver it more consistently, confidently with a neoadjuvant approach. But if we see them after surgery and the option is for adjuvant, yes, indeed, just like Charu, I think we follow what biologically makes a little bit more sense. And that is to follow the biomarker, TPS score high positive patients, EGFR negative, EGFR across negative, of course. Those patients, I think, are good candidates for adjuvant immunotherapy. We'll discuss the pros and cons. We'll have careful conversations. If they have autoimmune problems, then maybe the conversation is a bit different. But generally speaking, that's a good patient subset to very strongly consider adjuvant immunotherapy for.
It's interesting, though, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the adjuvant immunotherapy, at least with Pembro, I believe, is for any PD, like even in no PD-L1, right?
That's exactly right. And this is where the FDA, you know, I think couldn't do anything else than just simply, you know, look at the overall study results.
Right.
Approve pembrolizumab, while the subsets just don't make any sense. I think the clinician's enthusiasm will remain low to offer pembrolizumab for a TPS score zero patient. But we also have to admit that, you know, we're not so clear as to how good the biomarker is. And, you know, all of us know about a patient or two, well, you know, somehow the TPS score was done three separate ways and we got results, you know, that are completely separate. So are we truly trusting one PD-L1 score not to offer a patient adjuvant immunotherapy? I think the conversation is still appropriate, but I think, you know, clinicians are very capable of expressing their level of enthusiasm and making sure that patients understand that the likely benefit is much lower for that particular patient category.
And how did you decide Pembro or Atezo, Charu? Does it matter? I mean, I know Atezo you can't use if the stain is zero, for example, but if it's high, you just flip a coin or insurance or?
That's a very good question. I started using atezolizumab in the adjuvant setting, and I've sort of stuck with it. You know, would it be wrong to use pembrolizumab in the same population? Probably not. And I think many of my colleagues use it interchangeably. So I don't think there's any right or wrong answer here. I know, it, you know, you also know this, Shadi. Atezo and pembro have been approved in the metastatic setting in very similar situations, right? So they're both approved in PD-L1 high in the metastatic setting. They're both approved in combination with chemotherapy. So I don't think we think of these drugs really differently, and there's no wrong answer here.
So Balaj, when did the interest in neoadjuvant therapy, chemotherapy or immunotherapy or whatever therapy start? And for folks who are listening who may not know what neoadjuvant therapy, it's therapy we give before the definitive approach or the before surgery.
I think that goes back decades. You know, even in the chemotherapy era, there's a lot of literature on neoadjuvant chemotherapy, especially for borderline resectable cases, right? To try to, you know, make a tumor, you know, smaller, easier to remove, maybe avoid pneumonectomy. And the literature suggested that, yes, indeed, you could achieve the same outcomes whether you give chemo before or after. It just hasn't become very popular, but has been perfectly okay to give. Now, recently with immunotherapy, suddenly there's a biological value potentially, and that's been highlighted now through a series of studies, starting with animal studies, but then translating very well to neoadjuvant, you know, melanoma studies and rectal cancer and you name it, that basically the tumor being present kind of allows the immunotherapy to help educate the immune system. So it's kind of an in-situ vaccine. Earlier administration of immunotherapy, using that in-situ vaccine, you know, for the education of the immune system, you know, much more confident delivery. All this seems to play out very well now in the clinic, where in the neoadjuvant space, giving neoadjuvant immunotherapy alone, or especially with chemotherapy, really drastically transforms, you know, how, you know, patients respond in terms of major or complete pathological responses. And very nicely that translates into more firm clinical benefits, and that is event-free survival benefits and a very robust trend in terms of overall survival. The studies haven't been followed long enough that those OS benefits are called significant. But if you look at those curves, you do not need to be a rocket scientist to know that those trends will translate into very robust OS benefits over time.
Cheru, are we comparing neoadjuvant, which is giving treatment before, to adjuvant, which is giving therapy after? Is that what we're comparing, or what are we doing?
I wish we were comparing that, right? I think that's the biggest question now that we have approvals both in the neoadjuvant space and in the adjuvant space. There isn't a trial currently that is comparing the two approaches, but unfortunately what we have is a little bit more confusion where these perioperative trials are coming in that are adding both. So they're doing neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy followed by surgery, followed by a year of adjuvant immunotherapy. And it's adding to sort of our dilemma of how do you actually select the patients who are most likely to benefit from immunotherapy? And how do you potentially de-escalate treatment for those who've already achieved PATCR? Or how do you then intensify and escalate treatment for those who have not achieved a PATCR? Because I think if we have to learn from the breast literature or the breast world, who are, you know, really light years ahead of us, at least in this space, escalation of treatment following lack of path complete response following neoadjuvant treatment does work. So, you know, I think being able to select those patients would be the next step. But going back to your question, Shadi, we don't currently know if neoadjuvant is better than adjuvant other than doing cross-trial comparisons, which are always fraught with problems, as you know.
Because Balaj, I'm thinking, I mean, there's no question that neoadjuvant is better than nothing. Giving something with surgery is better than just doing surgery alone. But the question in my mind still remains, is giving it before or after better or equal?
You know, we don't know. And it sounds like we will not have that answer for quite some time. What we do know is that there's a tremendous benefit with the neoadjuvant approach. And maybe there's a significant benefit with adjuvant, but it hasn't read out yet to that level of confidence. So the enthusiasm is more for neoadjuvant. And they have now, we have four randomized studies showing the same. So there's great internal consistency, significant improvement in major complete pathological responses, event-free free survival, and overall survival, adding immunotherapy to neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Will it benefit some patients to receive more treatment afterwards in the adjuvant space? That's anyone's guess. The KEYNOTE-670 study came out a few weeks ago. You know, it does show some kind of intriguing, you know, hazard ratios, you know, for the adjuvant portion in patients who have not reached a pathological complete response. And maybe some clinicians will read into that saying that, well, maybe that suggests that the adjuvant is helpful here as well. So that's one possible read to give the complete package, maybe for those patients who have not had a complete pathological response. But just like Charu said, you know, we don't know. We'd love to answer that with randomized studies. And then what about the patients who have a pathological, you know, complete response? Are we okay not offering them any further treatment, or could they still benefit, you know, from some administration of immunotherapy? Not something that we know, but the outcomes are good enough there that maybe it's reasonable not to proceed with further treatment for those patients.
But just to level set, Balaj, what you're talking about is the trials compared neoadjuvant immunotherapy plus chemotherapy plus surgery compared to neoadjuvant chemotherapy plus surgery.
Correct.
Okay, so basically all what these trials showed, if you give immunotherapy to chemo, you're doing better than chemotherapy alone.
Correct, and the studies were a mix. You know, one of them did not offer adjuvant immunotherapy, you know, the CheckMate study, although it allowed clinicians to pick further treatment, while the other studies did use some adjuvant therapy as well. Very specifically, the AGN study, as well as the KEYNOTE-670 study, offered a year of adjuvant immunotherapy altogether in the experimental arm.
So this takes me, Charu, to the situation where a patient comes to you who hasn't had anything yet versus the one who came in who's already had surgery. Now, this comes in and you really have to make decisions. I think the locally advanced one, and I don't want to speak out of line, the locally advanced is probably an easier decision because you kind of feel you need to do something before surgery, right? I mean, I presume. I think the earlier one, the early, and the early, the one you classified early, and then locally advanced.
Yeah, exactly. So I think in my mind, the locally advanced are those who are either surgically unresectable or medically inoperable, and we are making a decision, no surgery. I think that's sort of like, okay, you're technically unresectable, you know, like multi-stage N2 disease or, you know, really big tumors requiring a pneumonectomy. Even though some of these patients were included on sort of these neoadjuvant clinical trials, I think for the most part, we go by the surgeon's recommendations. If they think that these patients are not surgically resectable, we tend to do sort of a chemo radiation followed by immunotherapy approach on those. And then on the other spectrum are your early, which, you know, like your stage one, the 2-centimeter peripheral nodule, no lymph nodes on radiographic imaging, really far off from the primary tumor. We don't really think we need to go in and sample the mediastinum because we think this is a stage 1A tumor. I don't think we need to think about neoadjuvant treatment for those. But really the middle category is where we want to think about. And these are the patients that we are thinking of in a very deliberate fashion at our tumor boards. Every patient is getting reviewed and discussed. If a surgeon is seeing these patients, they're bringing them to tumor board. If I'm seeing the patient, I'm bringing them to tumor board. And we're really thinking about how to best sequence therapies. We actually had to meet together as a group after all this data came out. We got all of our surgeons, all of our radiation oncologists, and all of our medical oncologists, pathologists, radiologists, actually in a physical room, which we hadn't done in a long time, because we had to make some decisions on how we're going to follow these patients. And I think one of the things that came out of it was that anyone with a stage 3A lung cancer has to be discussed at tumor board, has to be considered for neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy. You know, we are seeing clear signal for survival benefit in that situation, maybe potentially higher than we are seeing with just adjuvant chemo immunotherapy alone. So we really need to be cognizant. These are the highest risk patients. They are the highest risk for recurrence. And then for the stage twos, I think it's sort of like consider neoadjuvant chemo immunotherapy for select patients, depends on PD-L1, depends on patients' comorbidities, I think depends on a lot of other factors such as mutational status, histology, et cetera. And then, you know, it's sort of like if we bring these cases to our tumor board, the more multidisciplinary intervention we will, if they don't even come to tumor board, we're not even going to hear about them.
So Balaj, with the ADAURA trial, though, showing benefit to adjuvant osimertinib in EGFR mutant tumors, are there trials looking at neoadjuvant TKIs in EGFR mutant lung cancers?
There's been definitely a series of studies looking at that, and I think some of them, you know, will continue in different ways. As opposed to immunotherapy, I think the neoadjuvant literature hasn't become that compelling, you know, for the actual mutation positive patients. We see responses, you know, with neoadjuvant TKIs, but we rarely ever see complete pathological responses. So the benefit seems to be somewhat limited. That's the result that hasn't become standard of care. It remains experimental, investigational, but maybe as we learn about how to use maybe combination strategies in this particular space, we'll do better. So I think the investigations need to continue, but the current standard of care is not necessarily neoadjuvant, but definitely adjuvant. I think the ADAURA study, you know, very rare study leading to two plenary session presentations and two New England Journal papers, you know, from one study, truly, truly transformed the field in terms of the adjuvant benefit of molecularly targeted therapy, bringing precision medicine to the early stage setting, transforming both our pathways, but fortunately also the lives of our patients who have it, you know, high risk, you know, lung cancer, cancers resected, can have a very high chance of surviving without the cancer, you know, recurring. And now we know that actually translates to an overall survival benefit as well. Maybe the treatment is not cytotoxic, you know, it's just cytostatic, so it delays recurrence. But if it delays recurrence by a decade or two, you know, that ultimately is an overall survival benefit. So that's what we're seeing, that maybe the 3 years actually is not sufficient. And I think that should be the next wave of clinical studies to look at duration of therapy. Should it be more than 3 years? Should it be 5 years? Should that be indefinite in a way in this particular context? And we've learned from our breast cancer colleagues that in the adjuvant setting, you know, prolonged, you know, duration of adjuvant therapy sometimes is needed, can be beneficial, and can be tolerated, especially with drugs such as osimertinib, which really is a quite well-tolerated drug in general. Of course, it has side effects, maybe somewhere in some patients, but for the general patient, it's acceptable with a very highly functioning quality of life.
Charu, maybe can you share with us just some trials you are looking forward to in the next couple of years in that space, adjuvant, neoadjuvant? What should we be on the lookout for in terms of trials that might clarify some of these things or it may add to confusion?
Yeah, I mean, I think this whole space has just exploded. We have so many clinical trials in this space right now evaluating novel combinations in both neoadjuvant and the adjuvant space. You name any drug, and I think it's being studied in the neoadjuvant space, from ADCs to novel bispecific immunotherapy agents to several different other small molecules that are being studied. What I would love to see, and what I think is going to be really transformative in the next few years, is going to be studies that help us appropriately select patients. So I think this all-comers of approach of using four drugs on one patient and then showing a PATCR in 25, 28, 30%, and then leading to an EFS benefit is probably not what's going to move the space. What's really going to help us move the space is, how do we personalize this treatment? How do we find out, even if you have achieved a PATCR, how can we further minimize that risk? Potentially, it's by the use of ctDNA. A lot of companies are looking at MRD techniques. We are quite behind in our MRD technology compared to heme malignancies. Of course, it's much easier to detect MRD in heme malignancies. But I think with newer assays in the next few years, if we can design studies that evaluate ctDNA at different time points, help us assess MRD, and select the highest of the highest risk patients so that those are the patients in whom we can go in and offer escalated strategies, that's something that would be really meaningful and important to patients.
Or even de-escalation, right? I mean, I think if you're able to, let's say, MRD negative disease, and you say, you know what, I'm not going to give you anything, that would be just amazing. I just think it's going to take years to do that. Balaj, what are you looking for in that space? Anything that you're looking for? I would love for you to come and say, no more chemotherapy for anyone.
You know, you're mentioning that we actually just have a paper that should be in print looking at that exact scenario, looking at biomarker-specific patients with locally advanced lung cancer where the standard of care is concurrent chemoradiation, and switching that around, offering new adjuvant immunotherapy, no longer a need for chemotherapy, limited course of radiation with excellent outcomes. So yes, indeed, I think we can potentially come up for some patients with chemotherapy-free approaches. And I look forward to more of those studies. But I also look at, you know, all those exciting new agents coming out. And let me just throw out, you know, that these new antigen approaches, the vaccine approaches, are super exciting. At AACR, the melanoma presentation was really, you know, I had palpitations just listening to it. You know, this mRNA-based personalized, you know, new antigen vaccine making a real difference, you know, for patients in the context of immunotherapy. Those studies now are coming to the lung space, and I'm just so excited to see, you know, how we could all participate, get these studies done quickly to see if we can actually do even better with a very personalized immunotherapy approach, including new antigen vaccines.
I mean, you do get palpitations every time I tweet about baklava, so I'm not really sure that...
Or when I open your book, Toxic Exposures.
More Toxic Exposure. I like it. Well, Dr. Sharu Agrawal and Dr. Balaj Halmos, this was really a lot of fun. I think a lot of our listeners are going to enjoy just understanding what's happening, especially as all focus on world lung and what's happening in lung cancer. Thank you so much for everything you're doing and for continuing to progress in treating patients with lung cancer.
Thanks, Shadi. Thanks, Balaj. This was a lot of fun. Thank you for including me.
Thank you guys for having me.
Folks, thank you so much for listening to the Caris Molecular Minute podcast. I appreciate your support. Don't forget to subscribe to the show and rate it and write a brief review. And thank you to Drs. Agrawal and Halmos for being my esteemed guests on the Caris Molecular Minute podcast. Until next time, take care.